Sandra, are we at question 4 of 3C?
Thank you, David. So we finished with changes in two building blocks, which were the cash flows and the discount rate. We discussed that before the break. Now let's have a look at the third building block, and that's risk adjustment. And the staff recommendation is not to adjust for changes in the risk adjustment. Why is that? Because the change of the risk adjustment from one valuation date to the other one has basically two components, I would say. First of all, it's like the expected release of risk, what you expected, well, because time elapses and you're closer to, you're more certain about it. So this is like, you could call it the expected, the planned release of risk. But then there's the other one, and that's the unexpected change. So maybe there's more risk or less risk in that contract for whatever reason. Some would call it maybe also a change in price of risk. We heard that in recent board meetings. So what the staff think what the risk adjustment is just a current assessment of the riskiness. And it's really hard to distinguish where does it come from. Is it all the expected release of that or the expected less riskiness because time elapses, or is it maybe more or less risky because something has happened? So I personally would say that there needs to be more emphasis on that current and this actual experience of that risk adjustment. And I wouldn't see that as an adjustment of the estimate part in the risk adjustment. So this is why the staff recommends not to adjust the residual margin for changes in the risk adjustment.
Patch, you're being puzzled.
Yeah, I thought the recommendation was to do it. No? Because the way I read it, it says, does the board agree that insurers should recognize all changes in risk adjustment and profit and loss? Okay, as opposed to through the result. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Well read.
Gotcha. I thought you said through the residual margin.
Anyone feel like the yes? Over lunchtime?
Keep trying, David. Keep trying.
Steve. You haven't changed your mind at all.
No, I haven't. I don't see why you would unlock for changes in the cash flows and then not unlock for changes in the margin. It just doesn't seem to make any sense to me. No, the cash flows is your estimate of what the cash flow is going to be. This is partly your estimate of the standard deviation of those cash flows. I mean, they're tied into the same thing. So why wouldn't you unlock for this? I agree that there are three elements in the movement, the release from risk, change in the price of risk, change in the magnitude of risk, and I agree the sort of the programmed release from risk element, yeah, I wouldn't do that maybe, but the other two, I don't see the difference between that and the cash flows. I don't see the logic, the conceptual basis for this recommendation. And I didn't agree with the first one in the first place, but...
Well, the staff thinks it's too hard to distinguish.
So it's operational. But there are operational concerns all the way through it.
I don't see how you should be able to calculate that.
Well, I've been told that you can split the risk margin runoff into those three components.
But what do you mean by that?
Well, this was in the context of us discussing risk margin, composite margin, and I mean, if you're going to unlock anything, I'd unlock the residual margin for change in the risk margin because I think they're both elements of profit. So this would be the only one that I would consider unlocking for. But when we were debating about composite and risk margin, this sort of area came up, and when I spoke to some people about it, they indicated that identifying the components of the change in the risk margin is possible. So how much of it is a remeasurement because you're changing your estimate of risk or your price of risk, and how much of it is a runoff because of the passage of time?
I think it's not just operational. I think we are in this mixed model where you've got a liability measurement component and you have a residual margin. You are in this model where you've got a liability measurement component and you have a residual margin component, and this, to my mind, sits in between, and you could go either way. I think a lot of the discussion that you had at the last board meeting indicated that we think there is some value in seeing the changes in the risk adjustment go to profit or loss, and this is on the board, and that's where I put it. One of the reasons for doing that is that you're trying to show the changes where they go rather than smearing it out. If you take the changes and put them into residual margin and then smear them out again, you might well ask why we bothered.
But the statements you've just made, you could equally apply to the cash flows.
You could.
Why smooth those out?
And it's to do with, you know, you're on a continuum, it's where you take the line.
Elke?
I agree, this is a tricky question. You could probably decide it either way. The way I tried to operationalize it for myself was to say that the risk adjustment is rather a current assessment, like the experience compared to my estimates, and thus I would follow staff's argument. If you would consider that to be another estimate, well, you would have a hard time to say why not go against your margin. But it is a borderline decision. I would support staff nevertheless, if I'm the only one, perhaps.
PK?
Maybe I'm getting this wrong, but I thought risk adjustment does not stand on its own. It is dependent on the on the cash flows. And so if you're changing the cash flows, I don't understand why a commensurate change in the risk adjustment will not be flown through. There are two types of risk adjustment I would think about it, apart from the deviation, just to do that. Let's say it's a 10% of the cash flows, for simplicity. If cash flows changes and 10% remains, you're not affecting all the 10% change in the cash flows through risk adjustment. You're taking some of it through risk adjustment, some of it is not through residual margin. That doesn't make sense to me. So I think risk adjustment does not stand on its own for me. So it is dependent on the underlying cash flow. So I would, if I'm changing it, I would go to the whole thing.
But to be fair, PK, I think there are different situations. Your cash flows might change dramatically, but your risk adjustment might not, because you might be certain or more certain that those cash flows are changing.
Then there is no change to residual margin anyway, because of the risk adjustment.
You expect the cash flows to be changed, but that doesn't necessarily affect the risk adjustment. Yes, it might. It might be more risky at a point. But it's not a one-to-one change. If the cash flows are changing, the risk adjustment needs to change, not necessarily.
But if it's a percentage, let's take it's a purely a percentage number, then it changes accordingly. So I, what I'm trying to say is risk adjustment does not stand on its own. That's all I'm trying to say. And so that's where my disagreement starts from.
Okay, John?
Same thing. I agree with Stephen. It just seems counterintuitive to me. It also seems to me the risk is in the cash flows. The cash flows were going to run through OCI. Or, I'm sorry, whoop, got ahead of that game.
Which one are you at?
You're 0-2 today. What can I say, David?
I'm just seeing it all day, John.
Anyhow, I disagree.
Warren?
Well, I agree with the staff recommendation, but I think Stephen and John have got a very good point, and it really does start to worry me, and I hope some people start to reflect on earlier decisions, that if you're going to follow the logic here and include changes in the risk margin as an adjustment to the residual margin, then conceivably, you're going to be presenting some periods of profit and loss, a result that looks, you know, nice and smooth. It is nice and smooth, and there's a whole lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that are being absorbed in the residual margin, and your liability's sort of not changing as a result of that. And I think it's giving the impression that the nature of the business isn't really what it is. I mean, it's a business that involves risk, and there are uncertain cash flows, and I just really worry about what we're doing with this. I mean, one of the things that we'd hope that we would end up doing when we finished this project and had a standard that applied around the world was that it would be a good reflection of the nature of insurance business, and users would be able to understand that. More transparency, better able to make sensible decisions about whether to invest or not. And we go down this path, I think you're dressing it up to be something that it isn't. And I don't think that helps at all. So I think the logic takes you where Steve and John thinks it does, and I think Tom made a similar point earlier. And it just really worries me.
Ron, but just to clarify that with John and Stephen, you would adjust the receipt margin for changes in the estimates on the risk adjustment?
No, I wouldn't do any of this.
Okay.
I was pointing out the logic of the decisions earlier were not consistent with what you're recommending.
But John, if we went with what was voted on, what would you then vote?
Delaying some paragraphs.
So, any other
we can have another vote on this at some point.
Cause, yep.
Good.
You do it.
I hope some people are getting nervous. You getting nervous, PK?
I said after that gives you.
Any other comments?
Okay. Who would agree with the staff recommendation? I agree with it for a different reason.
Seven, eight, nine, ten.
So it's one on the P&L. Okay.
It's not on the trust mark.
Question five.
Okay, when we do this, we adjust the residual margin. The question is, how shall we do that? Should we try to do as if we would have known the change in estimate at inception and then catch up with what we've did since then, and it would be a retrospective application of that, or should we do that prospectively? That's the next question. I think clearly what would be maybe the natural is go back retrospectively, and I have a change in estimate. What would I have done maybe 5 years ago at the inception of that contract, and how would that have changed my residual margin, and how would I have allocated it since then? I think that would be the natural. On the other hand, when I change my estimate, that's not necessarily a reversal of a mistake I've made at inception. It's just I have more information now. So when we look at those insurance contracts, it might be, or many people tell us this is a huge organizational effort to track this, to go back every revaluation day, every reporting day, how has my estimate changed, and go back and then catch up again. And especially because it's not a reversal of a mistake, the staff came to the conclusion that it would make more sense to do this prospectively.
Okay.
I think just one thing to add is as we thought about this and where some of the staff were at was that if it was adjusting just the residual margin downward, meaning for unfavorable developments, then to do prospectively made more sense. But if you're also increasing the residual margin, then if you have a contract that's going to go 10 years and something happens in year 7 or 8 that actually is true economic changes and gains, now you've got this huge amount of gain that you're not taking in that 1 year. You're going to spread it over 2 years, which is maybe a little harder to explain to a user than saying, this happened in this year and this is what we're taking it, versus this happened in this year regarding past events and we're now going to take this forward. So it really depended on where you were going to make the changes, whether a prospective or retro made sense to some of the staff.
Okay. Question for staff and one clarification. I think the example, first of all, doesn't foot. There is a small change in the example, I think, because the cash flows, you say 15,000. I think the example works only if it's 10,500.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's one. The second point I want to make is that how much the staff is relying on the developments in the impairment, because this is also an open portfolio, how much the staff is relying on it to see the developments there to think about time proportionate aspects and recognize it to that point and things of that nature. Any parallels to be drawn, or is it bluntly do it prospectively and be done?
Well, I think because we also have a practical experience with the Australian approach, which does it prospectively, we felt comfortable with the recommendation to do it prospectively.
But you don't want to draw any parallels to that logic or any parts to change that? Or because it is very similar to that in my mind. This is an open portfolio issue. Do you have a residual margin? Do you need to change that? If you change that, how do you change that? And so
I'm more than Australian. I would like to think about it in connection with our other project developments. Not that Australia should be ignored, but I'm just saying that.
But that also goes into a direction how we should allocate the remainder. It goes into the next paper as well, because we need to look at how we want to allocate the residual margin. Well, if nothing happens, no estimate changes. And depending on that, that gives you also an idea if the prospective adjustment does make sense, because if you drive how much profit you will release over time. So also an effect on that.
Donald, you want to come in?
My whole way of thinking around why we unlocked the margin was about the fact that we were talking about changing an estimate because we had more information about the whole life of the contract. So I must be honest, I'm very uncomfortable with prospective. I think retrospective is the absolute right answer, and the only way that I would be comfortable, could be made comfortable with prospective, was if we were very strong on the argument that retrospective is inoperable. And I think it would have to be that. Otherwise, to my mind, this thing should be spread over the life. Certainly my feeling up to this point on the level of information insurers have about their contracts and what they're able and not able to do suggests it should be operational. So
that's the argument you put forward in the paper, Sander, that it's impractical to go backwards. Has that been tested at all?
I'm not sure if it has been tested. It's just that people said it's not feasible. But it hasn't been.
Here we go. Yes,
91. Restate, because there's changes in estimates, take it back.
So today, under specific to insurance, FAS 113, if you enter into a retrospective reinsurance agreement, you have a deferred gain. You do go ahead and you update it for assumptions, and you do a cumulative retrospective catch-up.
Yeah, but that's exactly. Yeah, that's a different.
That's a deferred gain. It's a deferred gain that then when you do change in assumptions for the liabilities that are part of that reinsurance agreement, that you do go back and you change that retrospective of whether how much you have.
But you wouldn't restate for change in estimates under IAS 8.
Yeah, exactly.
Here either, right? Are you suggesting restate?
I thought it was just a cum catch.
Yeah, cum catch.
We're talking about perspective here. We're talking about perspective here, and that's consistent with what IAS 8 says.
Okay, any other comments?
I just want to say I agreed with the first half of what Daryl was saying, and my whole reason for voting in favor of unlocking was I viewed it as a change in estimate, which I think the staff did as well. And the experiential losses, actual losses, the staff proposal is will hit P&L. So it's only the changes in prospective estimates. But then I didn't make the next jump and say do it retrospectively because, as Patrick said, and we don't have cumulative catch-up. We don't do accounting change in estimate retrospectively. All of ours are prospective, and so doing it prospective would be consistent with that.
Okay, any other comments? Can I ask the ISB then, those in favor of the staff recommendation, which is prospective? Okay. Are you going on to 3D?
Yes, I'd love to. Thank you, David. Here, agenda paper 3D. This is not anymore about unlocking. This is allocating. Okay. Where are we? So, first of all, what we need to confirm, and I hope you agree with me, is when we're talking about allocation of the residual margin, and to allocate means this margin should not become or be negative. We had a discussion in March where we decided that we will not allow day one gains, but we weren't that sure about day one losses. This would be, well, this paper is based on the assumption that residual margin is not negative and will not become negative. Okay. Seems good here. So then the other first question would be period of allocation. So over which period should we allocate the residual margin? In the ED, we specified the coverage period, and we would like to stick with that. So we think that in insurance, generally, the services are provided within the coverage period, so this profit should be allocated over the period as those services are transferred. The paper has some additional examples, like, for example, claims handling services. The staff believes this is purely administrative and that shouldn't have profit on that. It's not really the service you provide. So when you want to reflect how the services are transferred, you would normally use the coverage period. And then, and we talked about this in an unbundling, there might be distinct services that you need to unbundle that might need to be allocated, or the services are provided during a different coverage period, but this is not the question of this residual margin. And we would allocate it over the coverage period. So that would be another one to think about. And because this paper has just one question at the end, maybe we just go through that. But you let me know if you have questions. Okay, that would be the period. So we would stick with the coverage period. Now, allocation pattern. The ED said the allocation should go over using passage of time as a pattern, or a different one if they expect the timing of incurred claims and benefits have a different release pattern. So the objective here was that the release pattern should more or less follow the overheads, the unspecified uncertainties, and so on. And this is how the ED came up with this allocation pattern, which the board believed that would be simple, easy to be done. What we heard is that from outreach and comment letters and so on, that many said, passage of time is not necessarily the best allocation pattern, because how the services are transferred under the contract is not necessarily over passage of time. And if we just look at the expected claims and benefit payments, that as well is not necessarily reflecting how services are transferred. So staff thinks that being consistent as far as you can get with revenue recognition, where we look at how services are transferred, we would like to see a systemic basis that is consistent with the pattern of services provided under the contract.
The question.
Yeah.
The question is, would
a different application of the principle, you're saying articulate a principle but not prescriptive in terms of the methodology, would a different methodology be deemed to be a different application of the principle and hence an accounting change?
Well, I wouldn't say so. I mean, it really depends on you would look at the contract and what the contract does, and then you would choose a profit driver.
But presumably you couldn't change it midstream because you don't like the emergence, right?
Exactly, no.
Okay, so the answer is it would be deemed to be an accounting change if you tried to change the driver. Okay.
Okay, John and then Pat.
having difficulty understanding how this would work, how it'd be operationalized, given that somehow we're going to define a portfolio, not yet defined. Would this be some aggregation at a higher level than that definition, at a lower level? Or would it have to be consistent with? And to the extent that it's not, that mean that there are different patterns of recognition I could get depending on how I choose the level. Without having that anchor of what we mean by portfolio, I'm just not sure how to answer this.
Yeah. I mean, the next chapter would be unit of account, and I've been said that we shouldn't maybe look at unit of account because we haven't decided on portfolio. But, of course, first of all, we are accounting for an insurance contract, and you should choose the driver that is most appropriate for that contract. And we would guess that similar contract types and so on, and similarities in those pattern of services provided, that you could look at that on an aggregate level. But as we won't discuss unit of account today, but this is something to keep in mind when we look at portfolio definition.
But aren't you, in a way, looking at unit of account in C? You're talking about...
We're not going to do C today because of the comments that came earlier today.
Okay. Pat?
It struck me that amortizing or recognizing the residual margin over the coverage period was somehow, in my mind, inconsistent with unlocking the residual, because we're going to be adjusting the residual for changes in the cash flows and the estimates of the cash flows that are beyond the coverage period. But if we're going to recognize the residual over the coverage period, then we're only adjusting it for changes in all those cash flows until the coverage period ends. And so it seemed very inconsistent to me to recognize that residual margin over the coverage period once we'd unlocked the residual margin. To me, you should continue to adjust the residual margin for changes in the expected cash flows until they're done.
Just to that point, I think one thing to keep in mind here is that the coverage period for the non-life type contracts that might be under the modified approach would be that 1 year. You would see the swings in the estimates going through the P&L for non-life if it's over just the coverage period, versus a life contract that the coverage period is over the settlement period. The swings in the cash flow would be against the residual margin, so you'd have, lack of a better term, smoother earnings on a life side than the volatile earnings on a non-life contract, which would start to differentiate the two models, which I think the board's wanted to try to stay a little bit away from. So to Pat's point, it gets a little inconsistent between the two different types of business.
I think the rationale for going for the coverage period is that on the residual margin, what it's if you take the view that it's the expected profitability and that you're going to recognize that as it's earned, that the service you're providing for that residual margin comes in the coverage period, and that after the coverage period is over, you have what you owe, just the liability bit of it. So for a non-life contract, once you're past the year, then you just have the obligation and the changes in the estimate of that would come to profit or loss. For a life contract where you're getting the premiums in and the coverage period extends almost, it's mostly coverage period, then you put the residual margin over that period.
Assumi?
Right. So I would like to clarify the what is this kind of, say, allocation patterns. We just decided to float. So that means, residual margin at inception is 1,000. But due to the float, it changes, to reduce to 800. Then it's end of the first year. So now, remaining period, we have to allocate it. Then third year, it becomes, 900. Then remaining certain years, we have to allocate it. So the change in residual margin due to the floating effect should be moved first. Then the remaining balance should be amortized every year. So that is a calculation you have in mind?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's not clear to me. So I'll let you clarify.
Yes, sir.
First, I just want to completely agree with the points Pat just made. I had the same reaction, and maybe just to say it in a somewhat different way. The costs of doing claims handling are included in your estimate of the liability, are they not?
Yes.
And so the idea that we would defer acquisition costs, et cetera, all of these relating to all of the costs of fulfilling the contract, it wasn't clear to me why we would, I think, somewhat arbitrarily say limit it to the coverage period. And I was wondering if you considered just using the principle of allocating the residual on a systematic basis that's consistent with the pattern of transfer of services provided under the contract. Then we wouldn't need a practical expedient, which would become the standard, and then in cases where you do not have significant post-coverage handling, you would use the coverage period, but when you do, you would use the full estimated life. Did you consider that?
Yeah, thank you, Leslie, for bringing this up, because the comment letters, I would say the overwhelming majority was agreed that we should allocate a residual margin only over the coverage period. And some, especially when you look at the composite margin, said, well, it should be longer than that. And very few mentioned what you just said, that you choose it as the most appropriate to that contract type. So we consider that, I think, as kind of a practical expedient, the coverage period would, in the majority of cases, be the correct or the most appropriate period of time where you should allocate them.
But what's the harm of having it be a principle for those other cases where it's not?
For example, when you have a long tail of liability.
No, you were wrong.
Okay. When you have a long tail type of, not so much when you're settling claims over a long period, but where the tail actually could grow significantly, you know, from the original estimate. In theory, even though your coverage period ends, your profitability is impacted over that 10 years as the estimate of ultimate liability grows, right? So in theory, you would take in the profit on an accelerated basis in those circumstances. So that's where In the long tail non-life products, that's where this gives you a distorted outcome.
Correct.
Your point.
Yep.
Wiggle.
Now, I understand that the idea is to allocate over the coverage period. Then the basis is how can you figure out a systematic methodology? You know, there are uncertainty over the coverage period. And I remember we discussed different formulas, and once a time we put, you know, two type of flows into the equation, people feel, you know, it seems confusing. I agree, you know, the idea to allocate over coverage period seems reasonable, but how can we find a systematic method, you know, approach.
I would say you look at loss pattern. I mean, this is not, you know, I mean, the loss patterns for workers' comp, for example, or general liability are going to have a certain pattern. So it's not like you're just pulling, you know, these kind of time frames out of the air. I think there's evidence, historical evidence you can look to that you could allocate.
Now, let's assume, you know, the coverage period is 3 years. And the simple idea suggested to allocate, let's assume the residual margin is 300 each one hundred each year, but then you would say, you know, should spread over the tail, and the tail basis is the loss pattern, and then how will you split 300, split 100 into tail or 200 into tail? I'm not fully understand how to do it. You know, the beginning 3 years, very simple. You know, it's
you just allocate one third, and you want to allocate to the another 5 or 7 years, you know, claim period. How can you find a systematic way to do so? Now, this is my concern.
Any other comments? Amaro?
Thank you, Dave. I guess I'm trying to understand this a little bit, but most of the questions that have been raised, I guess, are somewhat related to the concept of portfolio. And really, when I go to the question three, if I answer the question three, I'm answering, in my view, I'm already agreeing with a concept of portfolio that will consider this. That's the reasoning for, I guess, most of the discussions around this, because even Weigu's point, it's somewhat the pattern will be associated, of course, to the portfolio and that group of contracts. So I feel uncomfortable in going to the questions in these papers without discussing, as John pointed out, I guess, in the beginning of the discussion of this paper, without discussing the concept of portfolio. Because I guess we are already deciding on the concept of portfolio if we respond to these questions.
I think you could decide on what allocation pattern you would like to use for one individual contract.
Yes, for one individual contract, I have no doubt.
And then as a second step, when we look at portfolio definition, we could say, can we do this on a more aggregate level?
Yes, but the questions are not for individual contracts. The unit of accounting that we are discussing here is for groups.
Yeah.
So it's, in my view, it's not adequate for us to discuss the group without discussing the concept of portfolio.
It seems to me that we are making it one important decision on portfolios in this paper, which is that it has to be based on some cohesive group of policies, some underlying circumstance, as opposed to the exposure draft definition of portfolio, which is however management groups them internally for whatever reason they might have. That's where we have been. But I think our paper here is really suggesting that it at least has to be a portfolio based on similar types of instruments. And that's why I kind of liked Leslie's proposal earlier on the allocation principle, and it was based on that.
Yeah. I'm not sure I agree with that, though.
Okay.
I thought, having not yet defined portfolio, it wasn't clear to me whether this could be a subset of a portfolio, whether it could be portions of different portfolio. So I just thought we needed to have that to come together first.
Okay.
Me too. I have some trouble with this one. To move to the cohort to the portfolio, because one of the reasons why we stick to the cohort is, starting pure time. Timing must be almost the same.
Yes.
So, but now expanded to portfolio, I'm not quite sure how to do that. So, and especially that some, if it is an open portfolio, it's a in and out. So, how to do that is not clear to me. So, I have a lot of concerns about the movement toward that. So, it's not clear to me to make decisions. With this information, it's not enough for me to make decisions.
I think what we're trying to do here is we're saying not the cohort, so it's more not the cohort. And we haven't discussed the definition of a portfolio more widely yet, so we didn't feel comfortable saying do the portfolio because we don't know what that is. But what we're trying to get at here was we were saying, well, what sort of aggregation could you see? And then we would come round and circle that with how that squares with the discussion on the portfolio and other parts of the standard at that point. And that's why it's a little bit vaguer than just saying the portfolio.
But say you would like to amortize over the coverage period.
Okay.
Say open portfolio, how to define the coverage period is not clear to me. How do you do that?
Well, the allocation pattern should be to be at least an approximation that over the coverage period of an individual contract, the residual margin would be released. This is how you should do it, and that should be possible to be done on a more aggregate level than on a contract level.
Let's say one portfolio, mm-hmm. and average coverage period, 5 years. You just apply 5 years for all the portfolio?
Now, for example, if your profit driver is the expected premium inflows, you will only get premiums during the coverage period. So if this is the driver, how much premium you're still expecting and you release according to that, it should be a natural release overall over the coverage period. And not using passage of time in that sense.
So if you use the premium received as a sort of the driver, so how do you prove within a portfolio?
Of course, it would be an approximation. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you need to track on an individual level or at least on a closed portfolio. You need to track is all gone off the residual margin. It will be an approximation if you do it on an open portfolio.
Yeah, and if the cancellation happens, you say, just starting, say, 5 years, but say in the second year, it has been cancelled. How do you follow that?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the problem even in a closed portfolio. You need to track it on this individual contract.
Yeah, so
otherwise, it will be an approximation only.
Yeah, so that part is it's not clear to me by reading this. So I have a lot of concerns about that.
Okay, Elke, and then Wiggle.
I agree with the concerns raised on the portfolio basis, and I think staff needs to think about how to make it operational. The only thing we know is that cohort is not operational. The other thing is, going back to the argument whether it's coverage period or settlement period. Now, for life insurance, that's a moot point because the extension beyond coverage period is nearly nil. For non-life, I would strongly advocate for staff's proposal to stick to the coverage period because that's the period you provide most of the service, and it gets fairly arbitrary how to allocate the residual margin for any longer period. It might be a fairly short period for some, and you might argue that I'm still at risk, but by my understanding, after the coverage period, I'm left with a liability. And applying general standards, I've got my cash outflows to estimate, I've got my risk margin to estimate, and my discount rate, but I'm not allocating future profit out of having sold the product over the remaining period until I've settled that liability. So I think, though it sounds a bit interesting to say we leave it to companies to decide whether they have provided most of the service during the coverage period or to go beyond, I think for clarity purposes for non-life, it would be helpful to say it's a coverage period and afterwards you're estimating a liability under the normal circumstances.
Okay. Wego?
Now, today, some of board members explained their worries about operationalities related to level of aggregations, and particularly if we're in the world of open portfolio. I agree with the concern, but I don't think the issue itself relates to the issue we will discuss. The concern relates to the issue we will discuss. If we want to say there is operational issues related to aggregation, particularly under the open portfolio, we have similar problems to decide that day one loss or gain, or to check whether there is an honest contract. You know, so I would think the decision on each piece is independent from the level of aggregation. Otherwise, will be endless journey for us to discuss.
Okay, any other comments? Oh, sorry, Jennifer. Do you want to come in on that point?
Mark.
Okay, Pat was just going, and then I'll come back to you, Mark.
To follow on with what I said before about my concern about recognizing it over the coverage period once we've unlocked the residual, to me, once we've unlocked the residual, I wouldn't amortize the residual in any way at all. I would continue to adjust it throughout the entire life of the contract, and whatever is left at the end, recognize it then. That's what I would do, as long as we've got it unlocked.
Be a good Calvinist. Yeah.
Just to... I don't know if I actually get to the same... I might end up at the same place as Pat, but I'm just trying to expand on Tatsumi's point, because I think he raises an excellent operational point. I'm trying to just understand, and whether you call it a portfolio, a cohort, or whatever, you're talking about a grouping of contracts, and it's an open situation with things going in and out, contracts going in and out. Now you've got unlocked and changes coming in and out. I literally don't know how you were doing an allocation. I mean, in the supplementary document, what we did is we had to come up with a weighted average life, right? And try to figure out, okay, now we've got the weighted average life, and figure out, at least then we had contractual cash flows with the maturity. Here we don't. I honestly don't know how you're talking about allocating this residual margin. And you know, to Pat's point, maybe you don't. Maybe you just have it just roll. But I don't know how you do it.
But I don't think it matters whether it's coverage or settlement either, yes. That concern.
No.
No, I'm talking about, right. I'm not talking about whether it's coverage. Right. I mean, honestly, when I first read this, I had the same concern you did. I didn't think it was coverage. I would have said coverage. I probably would have said the principle in the objective, but then in the application guidance that it's usually coverage period unless you have significant claims handling and other things that are in there. But I literally don't know how you do it when you have so many ins and outs. I just don't know how it's done.
Okay. Any other points? Well, can we just, we're not going to deal with the third part of this.
Just leave that.
Okay. The first one then is: does anyone believe that the residual margin should be negative? Okay. Well, we agree with that one. The second one is there's two issues on the table. One is: do we just make it the coverage period, or do we do as Leslie and Mark have suggested, that put a principle in and say normally it would be the coverage period, but there may be other reasons for doing something else. But let me put the be as it stands, so it's just the coverage period. Okay, ISB, who would agree with that? Just the coverage. 2, 3, 4, 5.
3, 4, 5, 6. Staff recommendation is written,
just,
David.
Just a minute.
Staff proposal.
Staff
as written, yes. Both 1 and 2. It has to be 1 and 2.
1 and 2. Okay. And the, okay, you quite happy?
One, right. Two.
Could we see again, please? Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay. Right. Well, looking at that, you know, I think this isn't going to be an easy thing to do. That unlocking decision is a really big one, and it's just on a wafer-thin majority of the board. But you've got the question of. What's experience versus estimate? You have to distinguish that. Steve made several points in that direction. You've got this major problem with the portfolios, which took us a long time in impairment, and we're still struggling with that. So this is not a minor issue, and how do you amortize if you're going to do that sort of thing? The estimates, favorable, unfavorable, cash flows, discount rates, but not risk adjustment. I must admit, I voted for risk adjustment probably for the wrong reasons. I didn't want anything else adjusting residual value. Perspective, and then we've got the coverage period is what you've agreed to here, and we have the question of the unit of account.
Would any of these certainly better or better?
Paul, clarification. I've been thinking about a comment you made, Paul, about
why you voted for unlocking. You said it was consistent with IS8. But changes in accounting estimates?
Yes, I think it is.
And I'm trying to understand why that is, because if you're measuring an item, a financial asset, a financial liability, or a liability under IS 37, and you change estimates, you recognise the change immediately. Don't you?
That's a fair value measurement.
Well, IS 37 is a current estimate of a liability. And we don't take that change in estimate and somehow defer it and spread it over a future period.
We're not purporting to measure these liabilities at fair value.
No, but 37 is a current estimate. 37 is a current estimate. It's using current estimates each period. Under 37, update discount rate, update expected cash flows.
I'm talking about insurance liability.
Yeah, okay, all I'm saying is I'm trying to understand why you would
because
use IS8 to rationalise.
I can answer you if you want.
Yep.
It's because we're changing the assumptions on which we make the measurement. It's not a fair it's not measuring fair value, but rather we have various factors, mortality, for example, and we are making a forward-looking estimate of and if the mortality, if our expectation of mortality changes, I think it's a prospective change. In the same way, if you change the depreciable life of a depreciable asset.
Yeah, that's different. I think the analogy I draw is with IS 37, and you know, you're making changes in assumptions about discount rates, expected cash outflow.
If you ate up your residual.
19's another one.
You'd recognize.
Well, sure. Oh, yes. I would.
Mark,
I'm just trying to... I just don't think it's a correct analogy. If that's what you're pinning your boat on... I just want to. I want a question.
I accept the Paul's explanation on the how why we you will spread over, but you say no. I think one thing different, as we all emphasize, it's different from 37. From day one, we accept there is no day one gain. You know if. We will have day one gains, yeah. And straightforward, follow your logic.
No. Yeah, but that's because we mucked around with the model in the first place. I'm trying to be consistent with how you account for changes in estimates in other places, that's all. So I just couldn't... I was thinking about it after you and I had the discussion, and I don't think the analogy is correct. It's inconsistent. You happen to have this... residual margin there that you can absorb things with. Yeah. That's because we did something on day one that was inconsistent with the model. It isn't.
Okay, any other comments? Does any of the guilty eight want to change their views?
I'm just trying to think now what our two models, how drastically different they look, and I don't think that they're all that different now. I mean, what you've got is a risk margin that's moving off it and getting resolved as you release from risk or risk resolution. And a composite margin a residual margin that is going to be run off over the coverage period. So your liability is going to go away faster than ours. But you won't have any cat. So in our residual margin is going to run off over the risk resolution period. So it'll be longer. So the pattern of benefit where the difference will be how the residual margin goes away. Yours will go away faster because you got a coverage period, but that won't make a difference in life. And the other place where it will be different is that the changes in the cash flow will go to income for us, but it'll be embedded in your residual margin for you. But that's the only difference is that are going on, and it
What's the same?
The little one?
The quick pick times.
The same as the risk margin's going away the same way. And if you think that we're taking the composite margin. No, we're remeasuring the cash flows to income.
We're not remeasuring
the composite margin.
Any part of it.
But their only remeasurement of the composite margin is taking the cash flows that were going to income and changing the residual margin for it.
Risk adjustment.
But that's the same as how our portion of the risk margin will be going out.
Yours doesn't.
Sure, hope try that's all.
Your one might. Theirs doesn't.
Also, we have another topic where we're very different.
Okay, acquisition costs.
What do we do next?
Acquisition costs. Three.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We're moving on to 3E
income amortization differences.
We're not going to do the last question this time. We're going to look at paper 3E now. Yes. Because it was clear from the earlier discussion that you're not ready to discuss the unit of account on the portfolio basis. Because you don't know what portfolio is yet. So I think what makes most sense is for us to bring back the definition of a portfolio and discuss whether you can aggregate it to a portfolio level at the same meeting. So that's what we're going to do. Yeah, I look forward to your insightful views on that.
You weren't paying attention.
3E. For echo. Okay, we can look at agenda paper 3E now. In February, the boards decided that the contract cash flows should include acquisition costs that relate to a portfolio of insurance contracts. And at the next meeting, the IASB and the FESB came to different tentative decisions on defining which acquisition costs could be included in the contract cash flows. So we have two papers here today. The first paper starts by providing some background about the reasons that the treatment of acquisition costs in the exposure draft and discussion paper were what they were. And then we describe the different tentative decisions that the boards reach, and there are really two differences. There's a difference between whether or not you include only successful efforts, acquisition costs relating to only successful efforts, or whether you include successful and unsuccessful efforts. That's the first difference. The second difference is whether you include only direct costs, or whether you include all costs that are directly attributable. That's the second difference. We set out the reasons for the boards supporting the decisions that each supported, and then we ask the boards whether, in the light of the fuller explanation, that they continue to support their earlier tentative decisions. And we put two paths, really. One is that you modify or retain one or the other of those two different decisions. And the other one would be to do something else, like, for example, to reconsider acquisition costs more generally, considering the approaches in the other projects. In terms of the reasons in the... I won't go into the ins and outs of the different reasons, except to observe that we've heard much talk of deferring the acquisition costs, and I think it's important to remember that in an insurance model, it's not a matter of deferring an asset that is separate from the contract. You could achieve the same effect of what the exposure draft does by recognizing all the acquisition costs as an expense and at the same time recognizing the part of the premium that covers that expense in profit or loss. So with that said, I'd like to pass over to Jennifer to talk about the other paper and other things.
Thanks, Andrea. Just one comment on that last point is that whether you recognized the acquisition costs as an asset or part of the liability, if you were amortizing the residual margin off over the coverage period, the liability would have the same effect as if you were amortizing an asset off. However, if we're unlocking the residual margin, now we can get some very different answers, and now it no longer is the same of what you are, what results you would have. But in looking at the cross-cutting issues, when we look at, paragraph 6 in agenda paper 3F and 70F, we look across the board and look at the decisions that have been reached and some of the similarities or differences. On unit of measurement, revenue recognitions, leases, and then where both boards are at on financial instruments is at the contract level. on insurance contracts, we decided to move to the portfolio level. And one of the reasons for that, which we've laid out in previous meetings and in the papers here, or in paper 3E, was there's a lot of efforts that are done at a portfolio level, such as the underwriting, the medical inspections, not for a one-off contract to get those. Presentation, obviously, it's as an asset in all of the other projects here. We've decided that it's part of the liability. And again, you can get it didn't matter as much when we had it locked in. Now it might matter more so because we could get different results as part of the liability. And then when we look across, we also say, well, whether it's direct costs or incremental costs. Now, revenue recognition and the IASB's financial instruments project, IFRS 9, are both very clear that it's just incremental costs. So in the insurance world, that would be essentially my commissions. However, leases, the FASB's financial instruments project, and where the FASB is at on its tentative decision for insurance would be those costs that are directly attributable to the acquisition. And so when you look down here, those are things such as compensation for your underwriters and for medical issuance, medical and inspection, policy issuance, et cetera, whereas the ISB's tentative decision here on insurance contracts also opens it up to indirect costs, which would be general overhead type costs, some indirect allocated costs. So we see just from a pure cross-cutting perspective, wanted to lay that out for the boards of where we're different, and we've talked about some of the reasons why. The other thing that we tried to lay out here is that while we've had a standard in the U.S., and that's followed in several other jurisdictions since, I'd say, 1982, there has been several lessons learned from having some general wording around what can be included. And we tried to lay out here things that were being included in acquisition costs that might have been in excess of what the boards had originally intended back in the day, and sort of as a caution to what would probably happen that could be in excess of what the boards here would maybe intend to be included. So things that we started to see were things such as agents' conventions, things such as training for the agents or for the underwriters because they need to learn how to sell the product. Some people would say, well, that's part of the product development and research. You need to know how to do it. Other people have now put it into acquisition costs because people need to be trained in order to go sell. So it was one of those that we tried to lay out in here in both the appendix and in some of the lessons learned. Some of the things that as people had dug deeper and researched into it, that they saw that there was a lot of maybe perceived abuses or, instead of using the word abuses, things that were much more in excess of what the boards had originally intended. So then we took a step back and said, let's completely look at acquisition costs in a totally different way than people have looked at it before. And if we think of insurance companies and we think about what they do, if we were to think about acquisition costs more in terms of it's not just my cost to go and get the business, but it's also my cost to produce the policy. So for every single person, basically, I have to customize that policy for Warren's life and where Warren lives in Australia and the longevity and his lifestyle and everything else. what his needs would be, what his beneficiaries' needs would be, what his debt is. The policy would be customized for each individual. If we are to go down the road of looking at this in light of an insurance contract being not only acquiring the contract but also producing the contract in order to sell it, could I then analogize to other guidance that is out there, such as inventory and construction contracts, and even some of the costs that the board has recently discussed around the pre-acquisition contract fulfillment in the revenue recognition project? If you were to be able to go beyond our initial thoughts of acquisition costs and to look at this as also the production of a policy, we would then look at that guidance. Some of the costs that would then be included would include things such as some of the rent space for the people that are actually performing the function of acquiring the contract, such as the underwriter, the medical inspection people, policy issuance, etc. But it would be really for those functions whose primary responsibility it is to acquire that policy and to produce that policy. So it wouldn't include all of the other allocated overhead, but just that piece for those people whose primary function it is, which we've heard over time as we've debated this, the COO and those type of people that people have problems with. So it would sort of expand some of the costs that to what the FASB's tentative decision is. It would limit a little bit more where the IASB's tentative decision is on what types of costs go into here. So that would be one of the discussion items. The next one would be as we look at this and we look at inventory and the pre-acquisition contract fulfillment and even construction contracts, where the probability of actually getting that contract, those costs are not included, or when a contract is not sold, those costs are written off. And so even for inventory, if you've got inventory out there that you're not selling, you're going to write off those costs. So wherever we looked, we couldn't find necessarily where for unsuccessful, drawing that analogy, again, trying to look elsewhere outside the box, where any costs for unsuccessful sales would continue to be included and not written off at the time that it was determined to be unsuccessful. So in the attempt, yes.
I'm just trying to understand in terms of the sensitivity around this issue, what the FASB's thinking was when it modified the accounting for acquisition costs recently. Was the sensitivity around successful, unsuccessful, or was it more around the pool of costs that was being swept in and capitalized was being interpreted too broadly? So that allocation... Would you say the sensitivity was more on the allocation of indirect costs or more on the successful, unsuccessful?
It varies by company, right?
The project started originally on the types of costs that were being included. And then during the research, we discovered that companies were deferring unsuccessful costs, and that's how it expanded. But I think that... I don't think it's possible to look at the final conclusion and say one was more important than the other in the task force's mind.
And when you came to the conclusion that you should just capitalize successful, were you doing that in the context of a portfolio analysis or a contract analysis? What was your unit of account?
I believe it was a contract analysis.
But it shouldn't matter. Yeah, I think that the concern is that when you talk about portfolio, you're talking about the portfolio of contracts you have. And therefore, it would only be for those successful. So as I wasn't there, that as we've gone back and tried to analogize or tried to understand it, I don't think it really mattered if it was in a contract or a portfolio because portfolio was defined as contracts you bought.
The only thing I would say is... Your conclusion might differ depending on whether you're saying you're acquiring a contract or whether you're acquiring a block of business, i.e. a portfolio. That's all.
Right. And so, right. And I think regardless of that, we tried to look to, again, thinking completely outside of the box, to inventory construction contracts and elsewhere where there are costs before the sale, and then at that point in time when you determine if it's sellable or it is going to go through, you would write off some of those costs. So this was an attempt to sort of move the ball forward from where the boards were at previously. And with that, I will let you open your minds to that and discuss those points.
Is it you, Pat?
Yeah. It's related, I think, to the question Pat was just raising. A few minutes ago, when we were talking about unlocking the residual, there was some concern about at what level we would be doing that, cohorts, portfolios, et cetera. And for me, the issue of what costs, acquisition costs we include is related to the same thing. And if we're going to be looking at the residual at a level other than the portfolio, it seems to me we have to look at the acquisition cost at the same level we're going to be looking at the residual, because the acquisition costs affect the size of the residual. So to me, it has to be the answer of what's included is determined, I guess we call it, by the unit of account. And if it's the portfolio, then I think you're acquiring a portfolio or a block of business, as Pat just said. But if we're looking at it at a lower level, it's a different asset that I'm acquiring. I might want to include different costs. So I think what we're talking about here is important to me.
Is that just on the successful efforts one, though? It's not the...
Yes, it's the successful efforts and which costs.
And which costs as well.
I thought, Pat, you were actually focusing on the other one, which costs, how large a group of costs should I include, and that might depend on whether the definition of portfolio, cohort, et cetera. But to me, whether you're talking a cohort, a portfolio, or a single contract, all of those are actual successful contracts. You don't have any unsuccessful contracts in a portfolio. And so I thought, to me anyway, the unsuccessful costs would never be included, no matter how much aggregation you have of the contracts under consideration.
Can I respond to that? Because as I recall the discussion, or at least my reasoning, when the board reached this conclusion, was at the portfolio level, if you were talking about the portfolio, it was going to be very difficult, if not impossible, for the insurer to identify what was successful and what wasn't successful at a portfolio level. Yeah. Andrea, help me out here. Is my recollection correct?
I think what we were arguing when we had the discussion is that when it comes back to Pat's idea of you're acquiring a block of business, in order to get a portfolio, you have had to make the effort you know that you have some unsuccessful ones in order to get that portfolio. If you're defining the costs in originating that portfolio, that necessarily includes the unsuccessful efforts.
Isn't that true in any business? In other words, when you're making consumer loans, you go through the same rigmarole whether they draw the loan or not. So in banking, for example, you do an allocation. You have cost studies, and you say, we land 70% of them, so we take 70% of the costs. It's not impossible.
So one of the things on that was moving to the portfolio level is because the incremental or direct costs, we couldn't, for a policy issuance person, it was hard to say that that was for a specific contract or for the medical inspection. However, while it is somewhat difficult to say, companies do track, and some of them do track, and some are putting in ways to track what is the amount of successful efforts. They know that they get X amount of applications in, and how many of those are successful. How much time do I spend on a contract that I might spend an hour on to deny it? I might spend 6 or 8 hours on a contract that I accept, because I have to spend more time and somewhere in between there. And so companies are looking at different methodologies to determine that today by doing cost studies.
Do you think that going down the path of the analysis you have in this paper, meaning including costs that fall into the bucket of perfectly linear step cost relationships and some semi-variable, that brings the two boards to a position where they could land that would capture what some people believe should be reflected in the acquisition of a block of business or portfolio versus those people who believe as Leslie said, you know, you should just account for those costs attributable to successful efforts. Would that bring us to a point where we're closer?
Well, you can have some of these perfectly linear, essentially linear, whatever, costs, and still have unsuccessful efforts. And so I think that there's the two questions of what costs to include, and then whether it be limited.
The semi-variable might capture some of it, but not necessarily all of it.
Can we just split the two questions, because otherwise we'll end up with conversations going backwards and forwards. Can we deal with the successful efforts first, and then we'll come on to, you know, which costs? If that's all right. Who's next? Daniel?
Working with the production analogy, to my mind, I went with it, and I was quite comfortable with the analogy and where it was going. I just got very uncomfortable with the answer right at the end, because to my mind, I think maybe the point we might have missed is that most of your production-type operations have an element of wastage, known wastage up front. There's an expected wastage, and that wastage is usually priced into the final product. To my mind, if I was going to draw the analogy here from an insurance perspective, I would have said that's the analogy, that this is wastage, and when you don't actually produce a contract at the end,
normal versus abnormal.
This is normal wastage, absolutely. You take that normal wastage into account, and that would then be captured in the unsuccessful acquisition costs. I also think I'm more sympathetic to the concept of normal wastage, normal unsuccessful acquisition costs being built into the contract on this basis, because of the fact that in insurance we've taken this decision, Warren, not to take day one profit. And in essence, what's included in that day one profit is precisely the income that would have been intended, if this was priced properly, to cover both unsuccessful and successful acquisition costs. So we've already decided to postpone that profit and not take it, but now we're taking the cost that's associated with that profit and not recognizing that, or recognizing that cost immediately. And it seems to me there's a disconnect there. So, that's where I get to, I think.
Okay, I've got Tatsumi, then Tom, is it, and Warren.
Can I ask a quick question on page 6, example 3? Just I'd like to understand the mechanism of the successful or unsuccessful. So in example 3, I'm totally wrong in the place.
Sorry, say again?
I'm 3E,
yes.
E for England.
Echo, yes.
Right. So example 3.
Yeah.
So in this example, an expense of 3 is expensed. As a result, due to the calculation mechanism of this composite margin,
is whether you take the unsuccessful acquisition.
I understand. Yeah, okay. So it becomes 9. So 3 of 9 is once the acquisition cost is recognized as unsuccessful one is recognized as expense. Due to this mechanism, say that corresponding figure is compared with the ISB's view, it's a 3 is recognized as liability, and it will be amortized over next remaining period, I think, if it is a part of the composite margin. My understanding of the example 3 is correct or not?
So under this, for under the FASB's view, that 3 is expensed when incurred.
Yep,
and so I don't include it in my liability.
No, but
under the ISBs, it's included in my liability. So therefore, the residual margin is lower.
Yeah, I would like to agree with you, but say by looking at this calculation of the composite or residual margin, it becomes 9.
The composite margin becomes 9 because I immediately expensed 3. So if I do my calculation here, of if I have premiums of 100, mm-hmm. and I have my expected cash flow of 90, right? So I've got a 10 different, so my expected cash flow is 90. If I add, you know, here one to my expected cash flow, my composite's 9. That means the other piece is expensed.
Basically, it doesn't matter which ones you include. The total liability is the same because you're calibrating
to the
premium.
No, it seems to me once it is expensed, it should not be reflected to the measurement of the liability. It seems to me that this 3 out of 9 is sort of once you recognize the expense, 3, and debit credit is liability, and you defer that say, recognize the expense over the remaining period.
Yeah. Yes, that's what happens. So I pick out cash.
Okay, it's cash, but say, but this calculation indicate to me you are
So the composite margin is expensing it as incurred. The ISB is basically deferring it over some period of time, which now is being unlocked, so it's not clear of how that's being.
Okay.
But in both cases, your total liability is 100 because the premium is 100.
I may be wrong, but I'm not yet convinced that it seems to me you are deferring profit as a profit in the future.
I think it's the other way around, Tatsumi.
It's the other way around.
Tom?
Okay.
Sorry. I'm really trying to figure out what we're trying to achieve with acquisition costs in this model in its entirety. And I'm sort of reacting to Warren's chastisement of our board last time as to what we were trying to get rid of these crazy deferred acquisition costs and building them up too large. Because it's really hard to be able to say that if I acquired a contract and I've got the benefit of getting the person, there's significant further benefits out of that acquisition. It's already occurred. What I don't understand is what we're achieving or what we're fighting for in this model. What's happened is we've got a residual margin that's, in our model, going over time according to release of risk. In yours, it's jumping around now. Because there's a bunch of stuff going into it, right? And so you've got this residual margin that's jumping around, and we have some cost that we're trying to attach to that residual margin called acquisition costs that somehow, pejoratively, I'll use the word, we're seeming to want to match over time. But your matching now is going to be a jumping matching because you're jumping a residual around, right? And you're going to jump the amortization of the acquisition cost as you jump the residual around. What we're doing is smoothing that over time in a way, but our release of the residual margin, the extent we have one, is based on the release of risk, which is jumping around. So we're amortizing off the acquisition cost according to how we recalibrate the risk margin. And so what I don't understand is what we're getting out of putting hardly any acquisition cost in this model, because what we're doing is pairing it up and amortizing it off according to either how we release risk or you remeasure the residual margin. And, well, we also have a whole other level of costs that don't qualify in here that we're going to treat as period costs that get bumped in as to how they go. So the income statement implications of what that residual margin's covering is that amount net of acquisition costs, but then net of all the indirect costs or all the other costs that we're treating as period. And that is the gross margin. And if we're going to end up having some very discrete bumpiness for the costs that are not in there, that are not direct costs, that are not acquisition costs, there's going to be some lumpiness in the gross margin coming out of it anyhow. I don't really understand what we're achieving by mapping up the acquisition costs and having them run off the same as what the risk margin's being released on our place or as how you remeasure your residual margin based on the unlocking. I think we're creating a really complicated monster and putting costs in there that are really not related to fulfillment. Okay, Warren?
Well, to Tom's point, I think all we're saying is that if you are not comfortable with a model that would on day one recognise some revenue to offset the acquisition costs that you have actually priced into your pricing of the contracts that you've sold, then we can achieve the same outcome by including them in the contract cash flows. It's as simple as that. That's the way I see it. And I don't see it as a complicated way of accounting for an asset that those costs represent, because I don't think those costs create an asset at all. I think they're merely costs that have been incurred by the insurer in assembling the portfolio of contracts. They expect to be compensated for having done that in their, and they do that in their pricing, and this is giving effect to that.
Yeah, so, Warren, so I thought I was convinced the way you wanted to do it previously is you wanted to have the residual margin be smaller. So what you'd end up doing is putting the cost in that are covered by it, and it ends up netting the smaller and smoothed over time.
That is the effect of it. Yes.
But unlocking the residual margin no longer makes it smaller. The residual margin now is bumping around and can get larger.
Well, would somebody else who supports unlocking like to answer Tom's question? Because
I'm putting them all together.
I think it's a valid observation, I must admit.
And this is really trying to bring it back to cross-cutting also, because we can debate the same issues that we've debated for the last two or three meetings. It's also trying to bring it back to what have we done in other projects. And so, Warren, to your point of in financial instruments, for example, trying to get lots of loans out there, but I don't get to include those costs for all of those loans, or I get to include certain costs. And so it is trying to say whether the boards want to be consistent with decisions elsewhere or not, to some extent. And we tried to open it up to look across the board of other guidance as well, since we weren't able to come to a decision with just looking at the current project. So that was one of the things here also.
I understand that. That wasn't the point I wanted to make. I was just responding to Tom. I just want to understand just how that might work in, making this distinction between successful and unsuccessful. So let's look at the case where you're using outside agents and you're paying a commission. Mm-hmm. So the payment to the agents is a payment for the activity that the agent's undertaken to acquire contracts for you, and that activity involves efforts that will be successful and unsuccessful. Would you envisage allocating that amount between successful and unsuccessful efforts of the agent? No? Yes?
No, I think in this case those are, for example, the commissions that I'm paying are truly incremental costs. So the same thing as what was decided on revenue recognition, that they are incremental costs, the same thing that was decided on financial instruments, the same thing that was decided on leases. Those are truly incremental costs. I think by expanding it to at least some of the production costs, people would say that covers, that's what the agent is charging for in their commissions, is some additional direct costs, not everything. But there wouldn't be a split for those agents for those costs. Those would fall sort of into that incremental bucket.
Okay.
Even though they're charging for it, but I mean, they're also taking their what you pay them and presumably making investments and having other income to also cover their other costs, just like an insurance company is doing, is making, having investments and covering other costs with income, et cetera.
My question is, would you allocate or not? So let's then shift.
Yeah, no.
Now we're looking at this activity being undertaken internally. And so that involves the internal staff calling potential customers, doing presentations, sending material out and so on, and those efforts may be successful or may not be successful. You'll get a mix of successful efforts. Are you going to allocate the salary and benefits of the internal staff that's undertaking that activity between those phone calls that resulted in a successful contract and those that didn't, cold calls?
I mean, I think
those presentations that they went and did that were successful and those that weren't.
So I think
how's that consistent with your other answer?
So I think there's a couple of things there when we look across the different projects. One is a lot of times the marketing and selling activity, so making presentations and all the other projects essentially is expensed as incurred. I mean, you see that throughout in RevRec and leases, you know, in general, construction contracts. So how do you then distinguish getting past that marketing piece of it, that advertising piece of it?
It's not advertising. This is actually...
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, because I was reacting to you said making presentations and all of that,
this is actually,
where I would say...
This is the... This but is the spiel you're giving, you know.
I've
had them visit me
exactly.
regularly. This is the effort they undertake, how great this product is and what I'm going to get out of it and so on.
Right. And I think some of that does...
Sometimes they get you to sign up, others they don't. And you want that...
To be
allocated?
Split between... Yeah, I mean, yes. And that would be consistent with other projects looking across the board to leases and to financial instruments and to others, that would be consistent, that you would not be including costs for contracts that you don't get. That is a cost of doing business. I mean, I think that would be the same thing with, you know, as much as we say insurance is unique, I think what the boards have been trying to do with this project is saying insurance isn't so unique. Yes, there's unique pieces to it, but it's not so unique, and that we should have some consistency. And so by including, you know, unsuccessful costs and everything that I do to get business is inconsistent with the fact that I have some certain period costs in general for every company. And why is it that much more unique to just insurance versus to...
And operationally, do you think it's difficult to allocate these costs over those various activities? I mean, is this a systems issue, a major systems issue?
We know insurance companies that operate in over 100 countries that are in the process of implementing this and are able to and believe that they will be able to implement this by the end of this year. So I'm not saying that it's a simple, completely simple, but I think that, and is it costly? It could be, but in relation to the rest of the changes being made in the insurance contracts project and across the board, I mean, all of these changes have costs associated with them. So I wouldn't say that it's exorbitant compared to the rest of the model of an expected cash flow.
Okay, we're running pretty late now, and I've got a whole lot of people wanting to speak. I've got Larry, Steve, John is your light was on, Paul was yours. Russ, was it okay? Pat, Wiggle. But Pat after that. Okay, Larry first.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Larry. I'll come back. I'll mark you. Steve?
I agree with Jennifer that we need to be consistent as we possibly can with decisions elsewhere. And if we are inconsistent, we have to have a good reason to justify that inconsistency. Now, we'll come back to which costs, because I put a marker down. I find it difficult to justify the inconsistency on the costs, and I changed that. But on the successful, unsuccessful efforts, I think there is a justification for being different in this case with insurance compared with the others. I think the unit of account is the portfolio, so I think we can justify looking at it on a portfolio basis. Having said that, I agree with Daryl about the abnormal wastage argument. So I think we would need to include wording along those lines to make sure that abnormal, unsuccessful aren't included in the capitalization. But other than that, I think looking at it on a portfolio basis is perfectly appropriate. I think it is important, though, that this number is not too large, so I have sympathy with what FASB has been doing in this area, and I think the mistake we made last time was chucking too much into it. So that table on page 3, all of those stuff down the bottom. So I've answered the next question, but I thought I might not get another chance.
John?
But it seems to me that all businesses price their product to compensate them for every bit of cost they're going to have.
Exactly.
And so I start, that argument doesn't help me that we're just trying to cover this bit. It would seem to me that if we were going to argue that you'd want to get everything. And it also seemed that when we started out way back when on insurance, we had a notion of a fair value model. I accept Warren's comment that if we were doing fair value, that there'd be a gain, and it could or might or would offset a lot of this. But I also remember back then we had a little model for revenue recognition on fair value, and the same thing would have happened. We moved off of both, and now all of a sudden, successful, we want to bring into both, but we want to bring unsuccessful into the other. I do not agree that looking at this on a portfolio basis is the basis for doing that. It seemed to me that the portfolio basis is a way, it's an expedient for coming up with some estimates of value, not for incorporating this piece into it. It also seems to me that we didn't just move away from recognizing day one. We moved away from fair value. We're not using fair value. We're not using credit. We're not doing certain things. And so why bring this into it? I think we're better off trying to keep revenue recognition and this the same in terms of what we recognize, what we don't. I accept that there's a problem with this in terms of allocation and measurement, a systems issue. I don't see why this is any greater than some of the other things we're trying to measure under this model. And particularly given some of the operational issues we just kind of blew away earlier, I don't see why we can't do this, and I'll take the point that companies were already doing.
That's unsuccessful.
I thought we were only talking about successful, unsuccessful, right?
You want to be consistent
with revenue. Well, different issue.
Although you would be on pre-acquisition.
Just let everyone else in first. I'll come to you at the end if you don't mind.
I believe the answer should be successful. I recognize that the measurement of the insurance contracts is on a portfolio basis, but to me, you have to obtain the insurance contract to be able to account for it on a portfolio basis, and so I don't understand how costs associated with not obtaining an insurance contract would be accounted for under an insurance contract model. So I think it should be limited only to successful costs. Unsuccessful costs are the cost of doing business. It happens in every other business, and every other industry does expense those as incurred.
Pat?
I'm willing to change my view on this and essentially go with successful, but along the lines of what I think you're introducing with the analogy to production costs and your observation, Leslie. There should be room for some allocation of costs that are directly attributable to the activity of acquiring contracts for those types of businesses that have different distribution. So that has to be factored in there, and I like the analogy. The other observation I was going to make is following up on Tom's comment, which I think is a very good one. And I would ask those board members who voted for unlocking to contemplate what he's talking about, because I think the effects of using unlocking the residual margin coupled with the amount of cost that you're factoring into the measurement of the liability, essentially puts you in a similar position to what you have under FASB Statement 97 today. You're using essentially an estimated gross profit in that standard to amortize your DAC. Here, I think indirectly, you would accomplish something very similar, and I think all it does is add complexity to the accounting. I wouldn't see that as a leap forward in terms of improvement. So I would just ask you to rethink that, and I favor the locked in for that reason. I think it makes it simpler.
Okay, well, we can't go back to that one again now, Pat. But, well, I'll try. Wiggle?
Not now.
Okay.
Yes, we can.
That'd be fine.
Yeah.
It seems, you know, some of us would say we should have a same requirement. Before that, can I ask you, let's look at the example three. I try to understand whether we're really, you know, on the same page or not. The example three has been used. Yes. You know, our board start with expense all of the acquisition costs first. Mm-hmm. Then the next step is to to recognize the expense and recognize same amount of revenue, and some of our members not agree with. Then we change into the current, you know, the equation. But as I understand, the idea not change at all. We not capitalized the acquisition costs. You will expense as you incur. But for insurance, as I understand, actually you, when you pay it, you just expense. Peter, first, I'm right. We will not capitalize 1 and 3.
Sorry, Peter.
If you just want to try.
Yeah, I think there are two different questions here, really. One is about how we do the initial measurements on day one, and the second is about how we present what happens on day one.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of people talking about capitalizing the costs, and I don't think that's what's going on in this model. I think what's going on is that we are measuring the liability initially with two components. There's the sum of the first three building blocks in the ISB model, and then there's a residual margin on top. And the question is how we measure that, how we establish that residual margin on day one. Now, the way we've decided to do it is by looking at the premium and then deducting part of the acquisition costs. And our rationale for that is that the policyholder is implicitly paying for two things. They're paying for the burden of the liability, so what you need to do to fulfill the liability, and the second thing they're paying for is the acquisition effort. And our objective is to measure the remaining fulfillment effort. And if we want to get a good measure of that, we don't want to include the acquisition effort in that initial measurement. So what we're doing on day one is establishing that measurement. We're not capitalizing the costs. Now, there's a separate question which I think is possibly leading some people astray, which is how we present that on day one. The way we presented it in the ED is to say that effectively we do it all sort of net, and we really no accounting entries happen on day one. I think there's an equally valid way of doing it, which would be to say that we recognise all the acquisition costs as an expense on day one, and then the parts that are included in that initial measurement are recognised as income on day one. And we may well end up there, depending on where we go on presentation. I think there's a lot of demand for some sort of volume information. If we end up there, we may well end up with that sort of presentation. I think we need to be very careful to keep those two questions distinct, what happens in the measurement model and what happens in the presentation model, and not let the presentation confuse us into thinking that we're capitalizing something on day one.
Now, Peter, confirm my understanding. You know, our board once discussed three different kind of methodology to treat acquisition costs. But the idea is the same. You know, expense as you paid, we never have the idea to capitalize acquisition costs, whatever the number is. But look at the FSV side. I think, as I understand, Jennifer, maybe I'm wrong, your mind still, you want to capitalize acquisition costs and spread over.
No. I mean, I think that regardless of, we've said that you can put it as part of the liability as well. We just think what you're including as part of that liability, it should be consistent whether you're including it as part of the liability or including it as an asset, you know, just consistent with all the other projects to some extent that you guys are looking at for the definition of what would be included. So here what we're doing is we're saying three of this should be expensed. You're not deferring three of this, whereas essentially what this is doing, in essence, in accounting terms, it's part of the liability, therefore I'm reducing my residual margin, therefore I am not recognizing
my question,
it.
No, Jennifer, my question is, can I finish first? My question is, $1,
mm-hmm.
In your mind, whether you will capitalize and allocate by some way?
Well, here's the way I think about this. If I compare example three to what we do on revenue recognition, okay? In revenue recognition, the $1 would be treated as an asset and it would be amortized over time. The $3, the difference between the ISB and the FASB's view, it'd be expensed in both cases in revenue recognition. What's occurring in the ISB's view is the $3 is recognized as a reduction of profit over time. So the ISB would recognize $6 of profit over time. There'd be no depiction of a $3 day one expense. The FASB would have a day one $3 expense and $9 of profit over time. So the net profit over time is the same, but it's the timing of it.
Right.
Now, this is the reason why I ask you whether one euro, one or 100 or 10, will you capitalize or not? As I understand, for us, you know, 1, 3, or 10 will always expense, particularly for the insurance contract. You know, normally we pay upfront, so just expense. So I really cannot understand the major difference in terms of net impact on income statement.
Right. So I believe under the ISB view, the $3 is expensed and revenue is recognized for $3, so there is no P&L impact on day one. But $6 over, say, the five-year coverage period. The FASB's view would say $3 expense, no revenue because it's excluded from the insurance activity because it's unsuccessful, and now you recognize $9 over time.
Right.
Yes. So it's a P&L timing standpoint.
There's no capitalization.
You have a high
profit. It's not really any approach. There's no capitalization.
Andrea, you wanted to come in?
I'm not sure I should have, but I will anyway. I wondered whether what Peter was saying about the other way of looking at it is that if you've got your $100 and you're covering, I would add three components to Peter's two. You've got the obligation, that the burden you bear, you've got the expected profitability, which we say is the residual margin, and then you have the acquisition costs. And if you say what we're trying to do is you're going to recognize the expense of $4 or $1, and at the same time recognize the part of the premium that covers that, either the 4 or 1, whether that kind of skews your views at all. Because then it's about the expense that you're recognizing on day one.
I just want to make sure. I thought I understood this issue coming in, but now I'm going back to example 3 to have everybody in the same place. It's suggesting here that we're assuming a 25% success rate. Does that mean a 25% acceptance rate? We expect for every 4 people we contact, one person accepts the contract. If in fact that was our going in expectation, is that not in fact a success for the entire program? And I'm curious about how we define success in this document. Is success that we hit our 25% acceptance rate, right? And therefore all of our costs are deferred, okay? Or will this be interpreted, and do the boards mean that it's 1 out of 4, so only 25% of our cost is deferred? Which one is it? Because the way it's written now, I would argue that you will have companies arguing for the former, not the latter.
Good clarification, Al.
Sorry.
Good clarification. I would have said the latter.
It would be the latter.
I know that the FASB would see it as the latter, but I'm curious as to whether or not, if that's in fact what we all mean and agree to, does the definition of success have to be beefed up here? Okay? Because I know that when I talked to companies in the past, they focused on anticipated acceptance rate, and if you had a 25% acceptance rate, that was a success. So I'm just put that on the table.
Now, the definition of success for ISB doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't. You're right. It doesn't.
But it's really...
But in terms of voting on it, I would want to know what success is.
Paul, it doesn't matter whether it's one contract or a portfolio. If you got to go up to 4 customers to get the 1, or if you got to go to 40 to get the 10, it's still the same. Unit of account doesn't matter.
So you guys got to beef up your definition of success.
There we go.
Okay, we're running pretty late. Tatsumi, you want to come in quickly?
No. The point Wiggle raised is exactly that I raised it. So, and say there's a different views, but I have a trouble with residual value difference in 6 and 9. It seems to me that when the say this residual composite margin should be amortized over the period as a sort of the gains and losses. So it seems to me day one you recognize 3 as expense, but by using this 9, you will recognize as gain over the period. Yeah, still I think in that way. So and I do not understand the mechanism of the successful or unsuccessful, as long as we use the plug in this mechanism. So that's the problem.
Okay, does anyone want to see any more unsuccessful efforts? We're still to deal with it.
I think Hal has a very good point. If you use a third party to acquire your contracts, and you pay 100 to that third party, an agent, if this third party has a success rate of 25%, the amount you pay to get one contract covers, in effect, the cost incurred for four contracts by that third party.
Yeah.
Okay. So indirect versus direct programs, very different cost. Okay.
Okay, can I put the question now? We're just going to deal with successful, and then we're going to spend, hopefully not long, on the other subjects, because we've got two other issues to get through today. Not on insurance, I may say, but first of all, successful efforts. Could I ask FASB first, who would propose staying with successful efforts, which I think is the FASB position. Successful efforts, FASB?
Yes.
Okay. Seven? Okay, FASB was seven. ISB, successful efforts?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
6. Okay, it's very close.
Wait, 6.
Can we try again? Successful efforts again?
6, 6, 5, 6.
Okay, there's a different. That'll have to be a question that has to be asked with the come out, because I think there'll be an exposure draft coming out of all this with the number of changes that's been taking place. Could we just look at the? Could we look at the? You think so? What about the individual costs? Could we just look at that first? Do you want to give a brief introduction?
Why don't you just bring people to the table on page in memo F? Is it page 3?
Yes.
Just as a visual aid.
So right now, on the costs where the FASB and the IASB were different was that the FASB was at direct costs attributable to acquiring the business, which would be none of the fixed costs, so things such as we had in memo 3E, which has the compensation for the underwriters, policy issuance, medical inspection, really just the compensation. That's consistent across the board with those types of activities that take place in obtaining a lease, and also for FASB for the financial instruments for loans. We don't need to talk about IFRS 9 or RevRec because none of these costs would be included at all. And then under the IASB, however, includes a lot of the other costs, which I think is where we've seen in the past some excessive costs just because of where it's at and where things have moved over time. And so really the questions come down to, does the FASB or the ISB and the ISB want to be consistent with the cost that would be included that is consistent with leases, which would be just those types of compensation, none of the, I guess what I'd call the fixed costs for the allocation of rent and space and all of that. Do they want to be consistent with including any costs that can be, you know, indirect costs that can be allocated to the portfolio, or do we look also to inventory and construction contracts where it's really costs that, even though some of them are indirect costs, but they're directly allocated to the function of the primary function of acquiring the business and not other indirect allocated costs. And so that can, we might, depending on where the boards go, either define it further, but we would look at it as some of the functions that are listed here, expanding from compensation to potentially some of the rent and the utilities and things, systems to actually produce the policy.
And the argument, Jennifer,
so it's really three.
A stable state, these would be period costs anyway and just disappear. Is that part of the argument too?
I'm sorry? Yes.
In a stable state, these would all be period costs and vanish.
Yes.
Okay. I would just mention that we had a meeting with our advisory council last week, and I think we even used this chart, and there were some companies in the room who have all of these activities. And they just said, look, it's fine to use different words, based on the unique activities in each of these industries, but to have fundamental differences in what kinds of costs are eligible for deferral is extremely confusing. And they just urged us to try to have a rationale of these costs and use different words to explain them in the different standards. That's fine. But we should think long and hard before we have completely different kinds of costs eligible for deferral.
Elkin?
No, I didn't say anything. Oh, sorry.
David, can I say a word on that?
Okay, and Larry is to come in. Yep, we'll keep you there.
I mean, that point of consistency was also very important to us, and we bore that in mind in preparing the guidance, that the draft guidance is in Agenda Paper 3E in the appendix. And we consciously built that as closely as possible on what's in IS 2 and IS 11 for that very reason. And we didn't actually see a reason to distinguish between that type of guidance for acquisition activities and that type of guidance for fulfillment activities. We want to try and build up on the same logic to avoid having ad hoc shopping lists.
Okay, Larry.
I don't have a problem with trying to obtain greater consistency with some of the other standards, but you know, when we first spoke to Jennifer about this, it was starting using the inventory model, and I guess to the point that John made earlier, which I thought was an excellent point that I also wanted to make, you know, all businesses price their products to recover all of their costs. Okay, so you can make a case then for capitalizing everything. And we just got to be very careful here because we're going to start going down a pretty slippery slope. You know, there are a lot of businesses where the sales effort to obtain a contract is pretty expensive, and there are a lot of costs involved that right now are period costs. Okay, and they just flow through. And we start, you know, if we go to the inventory model, we're going to find ourselves capitalizing a heck of a lot of costs out there that today are not capitalized. And I think we have to be very careful, you know. So I would be less prone to start capitalizing a lot of the indirect costs that are specified in this. But if we want to try to come a little bit closer to leases, et cetera, you know, I'm fine with that. But going down the inventory model, I am dead set against.
I want to pile on with that. I mean, if there's going to be a benchmark here, if you look at historically where we've collectively, more recent boards have looked at things, the place we haven't looked at things is inventory. I mean, that accounting, if you copied it from us, was established in the aughts, and not in the 2000 aughts. It was the 1900 knows, but 50s or 60s is where that is driven from. And if we look at where the boards have looked at these costs more recently, revenue recognition, leases, those other sorts of things, that's where I think the more current collective thinking is. And if I'm going to analogize, I'm going to want to do it to the more current thinking, not long, long time ago.
Okay. One of the things that's worth bearing in mind is that when we discussed acquisition costs the first time around, one of the I think it was one of the key reasons of moving to a portfolio basis rather than to the contract basis was that if you do it on a contract basis, different distribution channels give you different results, different types of costs which get included in the cash flows. If you stick with only direct costs rather than those that are directly attributable, then you'll have exactly the same effect. Because if you go through an external sales force or external commission, it will include these indirect type costs, whereas if you do it in-house, you will only be able to do the direct costs. So just for consistency with the logic that you use for the portfolio, suggests to me that you ought to consider capitalizing some of these other costs, yeah, or including in the cash flow some of these other costs.
Can I
reply to that? And I understand that there are differences. You can get differences depending upon what the distribution channel is. We have that in other businesses as well. And we don't go out of our way to try to build a specific model to account for those differences.
But you did that with the portfolio decision already.
Okay, Philippe.
Looking at this table on page 3,
comparing the different models, it's clear that the big, big difference between the three projects is those costs which are under paragraph 6. I agree that if you use an external channel to buy, to acquire your contracts, the items which are under 6A A to H will be part of the commission you will pay, because that third party will try to recover its cost through its commission. However, I think it is inherent to the fact of using another channel. It's a different business model. So, and I think Steve made a suggestion, I think, before. I would be happy to stop after 5 and say...
Where are you?
Page 3. It's a comparison, a comparative table between the three projects. So, I'm not very happy with the idea of incorporating into the... the amount recognized as profit, all those items, or actually to have the margin be affected by the items under 6, which are period costs for me. And I would be happy, for the sake of trying to find a compromise or a common solution with FASB, and to get in line with the other projects to stop after 5.
Okay, any other comments?
Yes. If we want to... We want to get in line with FASB, we should stop after 4.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Taking into account that we have different views on the successful versus unsuccessful, and I agree that will be the different point. That's for the time being, the difference. Now, not to create another difference, I will drop everything under 6. And we will have only 5 successful, unsuccessful as a difference.
Okay. Any other comments? Basically, what you're arguing is we scrap 6.
Yeah. That's considering this period.
Okay, fine. Quickly.
In light of your recent decision on acquisition costs, are you saying that the distribution model will ultimately have a different outcome in the effect on the balance sheet? So if you have an insurance company that uses no external third parties, for which they pay incremental costs, versus an organization that only employs salaried employees, for which, you know, there would be no, would you have a difference in the amount that you put up on the balance sheet?
Assuming their cost structures are exactly the same.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it's always the case when you have a make or buy decision.
Right.
If you make, you will not include in your inventory cost all your structure, administrative, etc., overheads. If you buy, that would be included in your purchase price. That's inherent in the different business model.
Yeah, okay. I get it. I just want to understand.
Elke, last one. Somebody else coming in?
I would agree with Philippe. There is an inherent difference between make and buy, but we solved by moving to the portfolio the most disturbing part of that. If you were to stick with just direct, you would have one company with all acquisition costs included and the other one has near nothing in. Here it is the make and buy distinction, but on a by far more limited basis, and I would agree to Philippe's proposal.
Okay. Well, can we put the argument now? We'll have to leave the successful effort as it stands at the moment. But basically, the proposal, I think, would be taking out, ISB would take out all the items under 6. But that's what you're proposing. And that's broadly what you're... Well, 5's the other argument we've just had. That would be in line with what you're proposing. Jennifer, is that right?
Yeah, I think that there would be,
given
yes.
that 5 has already been discussed.
Correct. So it would be either that there's 3 options here. 1, include everything that ISB originally voted for. 2, additional costs.
Okay, so we're talking about 6, getting rid of that one. So can I ask the ISB now... would you go for what I could call direct costs, which is stopping before 6? Who would vote for that? Who would go for direct costs?
1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14.
No, of course. Can I now ask you about whether you want to do the thing on the residual margin again? If you're starting to vote the right way. FASB, direct costs, who would support that, FASB?
Seven.
Can we get five?
No, five is the one that's to be done. Okay, so the tentative decisions are we're divided on successful versus unsuccessful. We all agree on direct. Okay, can we stop there now? We're running pretty late. Can we be back at 20 past and we'll start 20 past promptly?
Well, that's going to be an interesting one if you don't do that.
So you're buying your model. I have an old one. They added the